Should Charles abdicate after breaking his oath? Dr. Gavin Ashenden. Gavin, how have you been?
I've had a very exotic a week, about as exotic a week as one could ever desire. Or
the Maldives? The Congo?
No. The metaphysical intricacies of Cincinnati. But Cincinnati, Cincinnati itself is not a complex place. But I was privileged to be part of a retreat of some diocesan exorcists, amongst whom was our highly esteemed, handsome and clever colleague, Father Carlos Martins, as it happened. So I spent a week with these extraordinary men and was much the better for it.
Excellent. Fantastic. If anyone notices, my setting's a little bit different. I'm currently in one of the original 13 colonies, Connecticut. We happen to be the fifth state to ratify our constitution. And speaking of constitution, states and such, Gavin, I have to tell you, I saw a poster up, and let me read exactly what it says, because the poster says, "This Friday, protest against King Charles, 4 o'clock, Friday, July 3rd, Windsor Castle." Now, when I first thought that, you know, people are going to think, well, the anti-monarchists are at it again. But apparently, this has nothing to do with the anti-monarchists. And so what I want to ask you and talk about today, obviously, you have a connection with the royal family and a former connection with the Queen is, especially for our audiences outside of England, but in England as well, is we want to talk about what King Charles has done and how he has done it. We want to really cover that. So maybe you can help us unpack it, and you can tell us why this Friday outside the castle there'll be a massive protest.
You know, Justin, it's really odd. And it's hard to explain how this comes about. But effectively, we always knew that Prince Charles was uncomfortable with his oath to defend the faith. He always said so. Let me just go back and say, and give you a little bit of a history lesson. It might be interesting to some people, and I'll try not to make it too boring. A lot of people take their view of kingship or the monarchy from Disney, or from fairy tales. And the idea is that the king is in charge. But actually, in this country, the king and the monarchy are a bit of a tame poodle. So, and Catholics will be interested in how this came about. Henry VIII, a Catholic monarch, decided he wanted to be the anti-pope. And so he set himself up as the pope in this country. And the title we give was the supreme governor of the church, replacing the pope. Well, there were other anti-popes all through Europe in history. They came and went. The period of three popes in the Avignon exile was one of our worst ones. So this was just the kind of UK's version of it. However, there was then a struggle at the time of the Reformation between Protestants and Catholics, and the monarchy became a kind of hostage, and it swung one way and the other. It swung to the Protestants with Edward VI. It swung the other way back to the Catholics with Mary. It swung back to the Protestants with Elizabeth, and everyone thought that was fine and finished with. And then in came the Stuarts, and people were more worried by James I's big tongue and homosexual tendencies than his religious life. But when it came to his son, Charles I, he began to develop some sort of Catholic delusions of grandeur as far as the Puritans were concerned. And there was a civil war as a result. And the Puritans won it. So they said, right, well, now we're in charge. But on the other hand, we're upset that we killed the king. So let's invite the king back and try again. But let's be very clear, the Protestants have won. So back came Charles II. And he was more, his life was fuller of sort of carnivals and dancing than it was religious observance. But he did show some rather dangerous Catholic instincts, which the Puritans were very worried about. And they were right to be worried, because when he died and his son came, his son was ready to become this is James II, a fully fledged Roman Catholic. So there was trouble. They locked him in the Tower of London. And then they said, look, we don't want to chop your head off for being a Catholic. We've done that once, and it didn't get us very far, but we don't like it. So we're going to leave the door unlocked. Please contrive your escape and just go off somewhere else. So he was a charming and interesting man. I've been reading a new book on him, and and actually a man of greater integrity and substance than propaganda, Protestant propaganda allows. Meanwhile, Parliament then rubbed its hands together in 1688 and said, what are we going to do? We're not having this again. We're going to have a Protestant monarch. So they got a descendant of James II's who was married to a Dutch Protestant. And they said, why don't you come over and be, instead of protector of Orange, come and be king of England. And that was a real step up. So William and Mary came over, different Mary, of course. And then they gave way to the Hanoverians. But the deal was set by Parliament. Parliament said, we're inviting you not to be king, as in to have authority. We've got authority. But you can be the kind of cherry on the cake. But you must be Protestant. And one of the things Parliament had done was to give the monarchy back the title that was originally Catholic, which the Pope had given Henry, Defender of the Faith. Well, the Pope took it away when Henry misbehaved. It was given because he had written an attack on Luther's attack on the seven sacraments. But Parliament so liked the title. They thought this was a glamorous and honourable thing to have. And maybe it was one in the eye to the Pope to say, well, we'll give it to the king and it'll be Defender of the Protestant Faith. So it was that kind of baking into the monarchy, the title Defender of the Protestant Faith, that in one sense has led to the trouble we've got today, because it's handcuffs around Charles's wandering monarchical hands, because he swore an oath. In fact, his condition, a condition of being king, was the oath he swore to God that Parliament imposed upon him to be Defender of the Protestant Faith. Well, down the years, it all goes. And no one really has much trouble with this, because by now, the state in England has put out a lot of anti-Catholic propaganda. Everyone hates the Catholics. Nothing in it for a king to be Catholic. And you think the trouble was over until we got to Charles. Now, for Charles,
what year are we talking about now, Gavin?
Well, 1688 was when it started, and it just right. We run trouble-free from there onwards until today.
And before you say anything else, so everybody knows, because I notice people are confused. In England, the king is accountable to Parliament.
That's absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So much so that when Parliament sets out its new governing agenda, the king, like a puppet, reads out the Prime Minister's speech as if it's his speech. And this is a piece of English duplicity that Americans should, frankly, I want to use some vulgar language here, but let's say pour scorn on. It's just a piece of pantomime nonsense. Everyone knows it's not the king's speech. It's called the king's speech, but it's Parliament's political agenda. But the king, like a captive puppet, has to read it out because he's Parliament's creature. And all the oaths at the coronation are determined by Parliament. Parliament rules. So that brings us to today. And then the problem is not for once. Parliament always imagined that the only trouble it would really have would come from the Catholics. It's been terrified of the Catholic comeback. Well, there is a Catholic comeback, and I'm very much part of it. But it doesn't include the king. The king, instead, is doing this. Well, what happened when he was young was he fell under the influence of a very charismatic man, a South African called Laurens van der Post. Now, van der Post was a disciple of Carl Gustav Jung, who was a Gnostic para-Christian rogue and invented most of the psychological furniture that we have in our culture. And in particular, he liked the idea not of salvation, but of individuation. And individuation was essentially the coming together of the human consciousness and unconsciousness to provide a highly integrated personality. And if you like, all Jungian therapy is aimed in the direction of individuation. Now, against Freud, who'd set the anti-religious psychodynamics of the day, Jung took exactly the opposite view and said, really, the only way in which the consciousness, which is rational and has words, can get in touch with unconsciousness, the kind of stuff we find we're involved with in dreams and neurotic actions, is by having a communal language that doesn't involve words, because the unconsciousness can't do with words. It's a silent partner. And Jung said, this is what religion does. And when people said, any religion? He said, any religion. So Charles has picked this up. And what he did was he set himself the task of presiding over a multi-faith society. He wants to be defender of faith so that faith can help the process of individuation and that his guru, Jung's vision of a more mature, sophisticated, idolatrous, self-worshipping humanity can be achieved. Now, one of the things that Jung did was he piggybacked on Christianity. He used all the language of Christianity, and only at the last minute did he open the box, and you discovered that so far from the label on the Christian box, inside was something entirely opposite and different. And Charles is doing the same thing. He's taken on the office of a Christian king. He was crowned in a Christian ceremony. He made Christian oaths. And now he's leapt out of the Christian box and said, ha-ha, but I'm not Christian, I'm Jungian. And I'm going to change the conditions and terms by which I inherited this office. But because I know you weren't all like that, I'm going to do it a bit sneakily.
Before anything, so just to make it clear to the public, what exactly, so Charles was defender of the faith.
Yes, what exactly
the faith meaning the Church of England.
Yeah, that's
what
right.
What exactly did he change it to? And then we'll talk about how he did it.
Right. So he was supreme governor of the Church of England, right. And he was defender of the Protestant faith. So I need at this point really to get up my notes and just check for his exact words.
I think what we have is protector of the space for faith within the multi-faith nation.
Yes, that's exactly.
That is quite a mouthful.
That's what we have. Protector of the space for faith in a multi-faith nation.
So what's happened is the protector of the faith, originally given by the Pope to Henry VIII, obviously that went south, picked up, as you said, in 1688 by the Parliament and given to the monarchy since, the other day has suddenly been jettisoned to this new word salad. Sounds like something, you know, Kamala Harris or someone would come up with. And this is his new title. So this is what he has done. Now, the second thing we want to ask you is, you mentioned it rather sneakily. How did he go about sneaking this bizarre title in?
I'm just here cuddling myself with delight at the prospect that you've just presented me with, that Charles is the white man's version of Kamala Harris. I think that's so close to the truth. Neither of them have developed much mental muscle or eaten enough fish. I think it was P.G. Woodhouse who said fish was the answer to brains. First of all, he did warn us that he liked this, but we thought this was just him being a bit adolescent and a bit sort of, you know, this is my preference. But okay, guys, this is my preference, but I'll go along with the formula I have to use. But, you know, just like a bullshit kid, but this is what I like best. But he's gone further than that. What he's done is there's something called the Public Accounts Committee, and he has to declare his accounts to Parliament for scrutiny. And in this accounts document, which has, you know, preambles and introductions and defining paragraphs, he's slipped in the fact that he's changed his job title to protector of the sacred multi-faith space in a multi-faith nation, and is no longer defender of the faith. Now, does this have any status? Well, not by itself. I imagine they probably thought that the accountants on the Public Accounts Committee really wouldn't get at all excited by this and would ignore it. And it would be one, but it would be kind of lodged there as a piece of precedent that had stuck. And the longer it lodged there, the more the strength of the precedents wouldn't grow. It was clearly intended to change the climate of who he thought he was. But people, it happened last week. So we're on it and we're making something of it. And essentially, he's breaking his oath. He's changing it. So is changing breaking it? Yes, it is. And he's doing it in the name of something that doesn't even exist. There is no multi-faith space. The space in which different people believe different things is held by people who universally reject the idea of multi-faith. So Christians, if they're going to be faithful to Jesus, always head straight for multi-faith. They invade it. they break into it, and they bring the good news of Jesus to permeate it with the love of the gospel. Muslims do the same thing. They don't like sects. They don't like multi-faith either. And I think it's Surah 529, where they're obliged to fight members of who hold other faiths and impose a jizya tax upon them and make them Muslims. So there's
other options as well, I believe. I
believe there are other options too, and we don't want to be kicked off YouTube. So we'll leave that to people to delve into the Quran and find and ask them not to lose their heads with excitement.
Right, so it's over the research, yes.
Over the research. So Buddhists can even be a bit energetic about trying to explain their delight in the Buddha's teaching of the path to enlightenment. Sometimes they're not shy in invading the space with their own journey to enlightenment. No one believes in this sacred, safe space of interfaith, as if it's a thing, except Charles. And he's tried sneakily and deceptively, really, it looks like. Or someone's done it in his name to reconfigure his job title. And it doesn't make sense. It's not a good look. And actually, it's a betrayal of his promises.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit. We now know what he did and how he did it. Both are rather bizarre, the answer to both the questions. But let's talk a little bit about the consequences. I've heard a couple big A words being used, like should, and maybe you can address them. Should Charles abdicate after breaking his oath? Is that an option? What is your opinion on that? Some people say, listen, he made an oath. He broke it. He needs to abdicate.
Well, there's certainly a phrase doing the rounds that he's abdicated his responsibilities. And he has. That's quite clear. It's quite a good phrase, really. The verb fits. The question is, if a king abdicates his responsibilities, should he abdicate the throne? I think it depends how much you value integrity. If you think integrity is at the heart of oath-making and being a king in consequence, then probably so. The difficulty is that the Archbishop of York and the king, a number of clerics, are making use of their office to destroy the very foundation on which the office was created in the first place. And I think this applies to the king. I think what he's done is he's using the office of monarch to change the office of monarch. And that is, if you believe in the office of monarchy, that's an abuse. So probably, yes, I think if I was asked, I would say, you should probably go and do something else and leave the monarchy to people who are willing to believe in it. But you see, the trouble with that is there isn't anyone who believes in it, who's in line for the throne. Dear William, who's a very sweet helicopter pilot and has drunk deep in the wells of diversity, doesn't know if he believes in God or not, and is still to find out. So he's going to have trouble making sacred oaths in Westminster Abbey to a God he's already said that yesterday he didn't believe in, but today he believes in sufficiently to make oaths. So that's not really going to work. Could it go down to his son George? Well, I suppose we could have George doesn't believe anything. He's a child. Maybe that's the way around it. But there isn't an obvious solution. Playfully, I've been suggesting that if you want a monarchy and you don't want a Republican president, then there is an option open, and that's to go and dig out the youngest pretender, who is a Catholic, and he's a German count, a Catholic German count, descended from James II, and he would qualify to be king of these islands, so long as Parliament dropped the defender of the Protestant faith bit. Maybe if they change it to defender of the Catholic faith, that would suit everyone and it could be done with integrity. I don't think it's going to happen quickly, but I do like the idea, and it wakes people up as to what the issues might be.
How about the other big A word, apostasy? Is there any elements you see of that with what the king has done in abandoning his Christian faith?
Yes, I'm afraid so. There are syncretistic ways of being religious. Actually, being a Baha'i is one of them. He's naturally a Baha'i. And Carmel Harris might be a Baha'i too.
Right, the two of them would be.
I can see them making a sacred space of interfaith mutuality and dialogue together. They'd be very happy and content and enlightened and articulate. If you occupy a public office that has some form of ecclesiastical currency to it, and you trade it in for something else, we've always called that apostasy. So I think and there is a kind of sacrality or sacredness about the idea of kingship that is sort of almost episcopal in nature. I think sufficiently close to say that this is apostasy as well as oath breaking, and ought to be material to make him consider abdication.
The poster that's up about this Friday's protest, I want to read you what it says on the poster. It says, 4 o'clock, Friday, July 3rd, Windsor Castle. They're protesting against King Charles because he, one, promoting Islam while neglecting the persecuted church, two, dishonor and lack of defense of the faith, and number three, lack of honor to Christ. These are the three things listed on the poster. These are serious charges here. What's your feeling about that and the people going to that protest?
I think it's very well articulated. Two of the things that have most upset me about the way Christianity has been treated in this Christian realm that Charles has promised to protect and defend are representative of other similar ills. But one was when this really rather astonishingly brave Iranian Muslim convert, whose name I forget, but you might remember, spoke at Speaker's Corner, and she was knifed in the throat by a Muslim who thought that the Quranic penalty for apostasy ought to be applied to her. And she survived being cut to death with this knife to the throat and asked for the help of the police. And the help they gave her was to arrest her. On the whole, when people have been stabbed by other religions in this country, the police arrest the Christian who's been stabbed. It's public policy nowadays. Right. And the thing is, if Charles...
Is her name Ayan Ali, Kirsi Ali?
It's not Hirsi Ali. She's also a Muslim convert. But right. It was Tika something. I'm really sorry. So apologize that my cultural deficit means I can't remember foreign Arabic names. But a quick Google will find her. That's an example of the way in which Christians are intimidated. You could add to it the show of strength of the Muslim prayer meeting outside 10 Downing Street when they block the road and kneel down to kiss the gravel in the name of Muhammad. And the police, again, did nothing to move this group of 1,000 Muslims who were blocking what used to be called the King's Highway. Another one, of course, was the way in which Catholics who pray outside abortion clinics are standing quietly on the pavement, not walking around, are approached by the police and asked what their thoughts are. And if they say yes, when they're asked, because they do get asked, are you praying? The police then arrest them for the thought crime of prayer. I would have thought this was so egregious an abuse of the state and of the police that any king with any sympathy to Christ would want to talk, to have talks to the government behind the scenes. But Charles, there's no evidence Charles has done that. So there really is a role. If ever there was a role, it's today to protect the Protestant faith as well as Catholics. But it's not one that Charles seems willing to exercise.
Do you think in some ways, obviously there's going to be a protest, this is shocking, but in some ways this is a good thing that has happened, in that the farce is up. It was an uncomfortable time. We all know King Charles keeps having these Islamic celebrations in the buildings. It's been an uncomfortable time period, and maybe there can be something cathartic that comes out of him finally just staying it, getting it out in the open, and maybe this will be helpful to precipitate some sort of change. Do you think, in other words, is it a bit of a relief in the sense this has happened?
I'm very glad someone's taken notice. I mean, I've taken notice and was offended by it and written by it. In fact, I've been very surprised that a YouTube I did of my video is heading towards 100,000 hits. It's so there's an appetite to find out and to be concerned for it. So that's my own personal evidence. I'm very pleased there's an appetite. Yes, I think this needs to come to public attention. The point is the people who should be protesting or concerned or making a noise about it are members of the Houses of Parliament. But actually, there are very few Christians amongst them. And so one of the issues this raises is whether or not you can have a monarchy in the political and religious culture of Great Britain today, because Parliament isn't Christian. It has a chaplain and it has prayers, but there are no Christian voices and very few practicing Christians amongst the MPs. They don't care whether Charles believes in multi-faith, interfaith, quasi-faith, para-faith, or no faith. No concern to them. So they're not going to hold him accountable. I suppose, therefore, the people who should be accountable, hold him accountable. Well, I think Anglicans should be outraged that the chief supreme governor of their church has apostatized in the way that he has and has left them unrepresented and undefended. And I think other Christians can share in our brother Christians' outrage that they've been treated in this way by, well, frankly, rather a selfish and underdeveloped monarch.
From a Catholic point of view, England was a Catholic nation. Then this all changed, obviously, with Henry VIII. There were a few hiccups back and forth. But from an overall Catholic point of view, obviously, we're talking conjecture. But do you see this as the beginning of a path to get England back to the Catholic faith?
Yes, I have to see that, because that's what I pray for and ask God to facilitate. And the perspective of that is that we were pagan here once. And the thing is, paganism, as our dear friend John Davidson has so cogently written about, paganism is not an attractive religion. And more often than not, it spills over into sacrificing your own children to placate the gods who are effectively demons. It's a pretty ugly way of managing your metaphysical longing. And it was the Catholic Church that overcame paganism in this country. And it did so formally. It was here from St. Alban onwards and before in the 3rd century. But it got a formal platform under St. Augustine in the end of the 500s. And effectively, one can date the presence, the formal presence of Catholicism in the country from 597. So for 1,000 years, we were Christians. For 1,000 years, we defended paganism, and we did all the things Christians are very good at. We laid a constitutional basis which allowed for justice. It tamed the proud and the strong and defended the weak and the vulnerable. It produced education. The monks and the monasteries were the most extraordinary reservoir of learning, teaching, social support, social control, producing hospitals, infirmaries, and nursing, and social care, network to catch the fallen. People don't know, but there were very often in monasteries larger numbers of lay people who had come there for help and who produced a kind of core community around the praying monks, and they were actually monks themselves. They produced a nuclei of communities that worked for the good and literally rescued people. For 1,000 years, this produced the most beautiful buildings, the most beautiful music, some of the most beautiful jurisprudence, some of the most effective philosophy, and some of the most equitable social covenants that the world has ever known, and some of the best science. Almost all the early scientists were Catholic monks and priests. And this, which, you know, the whole Galileo mistelling completely obscures. So we can be very proud of the 1,000-year legacy that Christian Western civilization has built upon. You can make an argument that's very difficult to rebut, that all the things we really like about it, that the atheists and the humanists like, are Catholic virtues. So, yes, all articulate Catholics are praying and working hard to bring Mary's dowry back to her. It's good for the people. It's good for civilization. It's good for salvation. It's good for everybody. But we can only do it with the help and the grace of God. So we're willing to do it. We need God's help.
Okay. So, you know, in summary, I'd like to say, listening to you, Gavin, this is obviously a very, very interesting issue for people here in the United States, but around the world. But I think what we see is, as you said, ultimately, there's going to be these protests. There's going to be a lot going on. But what we've seen for the last decades is just an ignoring of the Christian faith in your country, in England. And I personally feel, as you do, you're part of the New English Catholic, that the only solution, ultimately, we can dally more, there can be protests, but we've seen a crumbling of the Church of England from the top down. As you noted, they're self-sabotaging their own church. So hopefully from this action, ultimately, the Catholic faith, as in the song Jerusalem, that green land can once again return to England and bless that land again. So thank you, Gavin. It's great seeing you. And let's get back together and explore these issues further.
Fine. And perhaps we could ask people to like and share this so that actually we grow the audience, because we need to galvanize a degree of Christian outrage, ideally far beyond the shores of England, in order perhaps to shake up the establishment here a little bit. So that would be very great help to us.
God bless to that. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
If we have to choose between the King and Christ, we're going to choose Christ. We've been told in the last couple of days that the King is going to protect the space for faith within the multi-faith nation. It's a new definition of his official role. Buckingham Palace has just unveiled a significant revision of the King's official role with a newly released sovereign grant report describing His Majesty as a protector of faith across Britain's diverse religious landscape. You always know there's going to be trouble when they bring in the word diversity. It's the new religion. What appears to be an adjustment of his coronation oaths, if he has the authority to do such a thing, is in fact a betrayal of his office and of his Christian faith and of his subjects. To be a follower of Christ means to acknowledge him as the unique presence of God, bearing in his own body the salvation of the world. In every stage in human history, kings, emperors, and others have claimed this for themselves. The early church was forged in the white heat of the competition between the hubristic ambition of rulers and the recognition that Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life exclusively. The moments in Christian history when this crystallizes are among the most poignant and powerful. One example is the martyrdom of Polycarp in AD 160. The latest Roman emperor had claimed to be God. All his subjects had to worship him by burning a grain of incense in recognition of his claims. They contradicted those of Christ. A centurion tried to persuade Polycarp simply to offer a few grains of incense to the emperor, telling him it was not his job. He had not become a Roman centurion to kill old men. But Polycarp refused, recognizing the significance of the act and its incompatibility with his witness and devotion to Jesus. They burnt him alive. The history of Christian martyrdoms is filled with Polycarps. The early Christians were sent to the lions because they refused to compromise on their allegiance to Jesus as uniquely God amongst us, God from light, God, light from light. Our own culture has brought two assaults against the authority of Jesus and the revelation of the Gospels in the last few centuries. The first is to deny there is a God at all. There are no gods of any kind. The second is to suggest there are many gods and they are all equal. You can adopt any one or any combination of them you like. The first is an absolute disposition, the second a relativist one. Both are equally dangerous and inimical to Christ, to what he taught, and to those who follow him. The 20th century was particularly aggressive dogmatically in its refusal to recognize the existence of any metaphysical reality beyond what can be measured, This was always politically convenient, replacing transcendent authority with the power of the state, or with whatever dominant pragmatic or philosophical agency happened to hold power. At the end of the 20th century, the spiritual and metaphysical needs of humanity to make sense of the world, to feed its spiritual hunger, broke through the surface of the concrete of empirical atheism, but did so in a new climate of relativism. There was no absolute standard by which the truth could be negotiated, it was thought, and so, as so often, the unique claims of Jesus were downgraded to be just one way, one spirituality, one religion amongst many. This, of course, is not just a position, it is a repudiation of the primacy of God, replacing him with a different God, us, humanity itself. Our judgment, our preferences. It is a form of solipsistic idolatry in which humanity becomes the arbiter of truth and reality. We make ourselves God. We replace our Creator and his claims with our own centrality and our own self-sufficiency. But this is not only a challenge to common sense, since it's clear we did not make ourselves. We cannot claim to be the Creator. It's an act of rebellion. It's in direct contrast to the claims of the living God, who made himself known through the prophets and the law of Israel, and finally, in the incarnation of Christ. So there are questions of allegiance and authority in terms of what Charles has done. When King Charles takes upon himself the authority to confront the claims of Christ and to reverse the hierarchy of the divine by replacing Christian philosophy and spirituality with the relativism of multi-faith, this is not just an act of dilution. It's an act of active rebellion. It needs to be seen for what it is, the repudiation of the claims of Christ. But beyond that, it needs to be seen as an inept and politically and philosophically unrealistic in its assessment of the claims of different religions. For Islam does not affect this, accept this relativization of reality, and it uses the ineptness of Western liberalism to advance its own absolutist claims. This has been politically very successful. In the context of Great Britain today, political preference has been given to the rights of the immigrant, and particularly the rights of Islam. You can, for example, have an Islamic prayer meeting that blocks the entrance to Downing Street and constitutes a show of political and religious power, and the police will not interfere. But if you read the gospel in the street, offending same-sex attracted couples, or you stand praying silently within a designated area near an abortion clinic, the police will arrest you. In other words, the king's new stance on religion, proclaiming religions to be indistinguishable from one another and equal to one another, fails not only the demands of his office, it fails even to offer the basic protection of free speech and the primacy of conscience for Christians. It does not even afford Christian protection in the body politic. If all religions are the same and all equally deserving of protection, it ought to follow that Christian witness, Christian ethics, and Christian allegiance should be protected by the law as any other, and we know they are not. So this is an act of betrayal by the king. In making himself the mouthpiece of an alternative religious philosophy, Charles III not only betrays his Christian subjects, he betrays his own office and his forebears, stretching back over 1,500 years. He betrays them and the civilization they founded and gave their lives for. A repudiation instantly that only became possible because of the rejection of Catholicism by Henry VIII in 1534, when he made himself the antipope, and by Parliament in 1688, when it outlawed the Catholic monarchy. Both began a process that inexorably led to the position that Charles has initiated today. Once you abandon the church that Jesus founded and repudiate the successors of the apostles, you open the way to exactly the reversal of faith that has been inflicted on us by a relativistic monarch. How has Charles repudiated his own royal inheritance? I think one of the most powerful articulations I've heard of this came from St. Edmund Campion, a Jesuit priest whom the Protestant state tortured and executed when he challenged its repudiation of the Catholic faith. At his trial, St. Edmund Campion warned his judges that in condemning him, they were condemning, quote, all your own ancestors, all the ancient priests, bishops and kings, all that was once the glory of England, 1,000 years of faith. He knew the Catholic faith was not a foreign import, but the faith that had shaped England for 1,000 years, her saints, her monasteries, her learning, her laws, her coronation oath, and above all, the holy sacrifice of the Mass. We owe that inheritance a debt of gratitude. We owe it our allegiance. We owe it to the saints who built this country, to the martyrs who died rather than betray Christ, to the Mass that nourished them, and to those monarchs who understood their authority was held under Christ rather than above him. Each generation has its own emperor. Each generation provides its own incense. Each generation must decide where its ultimate allegiance lies. If the king has repudiated Christ and his own forebears, he runs the risk of our repudiating him. If he makes us choose between him and Christ, like Polycarp and St. Edmund Campion, and numberless others, we must and will choose Christ.